And next we'll hear the third in a series of panels from the Gay Academic Union Conference held at NYU's Loeb Student Center on November 29th and 30th of this year. The panelists are Janet Cooper, speaking on female crushes, friendships, and affections in children's literature, and Cynthia Secor, speaking on The Sensuous Woman by G.S. and J.J., Gertrude Stein and James Joyce. The speakers are introduced by the chairwoman of the panel, Virginia Apuzzo.
To get into some exciting areas, and also reminded of the fact that we would like very much to have some interaction with the audience, I decided to scrap my introduction and save my comments for either the middle or the end if time allows. So without any further ado, I would like to introduce Janet Cooper. For those of you who were here yesterday and heard Janet speak about her experiences in Pennsylvania, there's not too much need for an introduction. Very briefly, Janet's active in Homophiles of Penn State, Delaware Dyke Separatists, the Task Force on Gay Liberation, and you can read it on page 17 because it goes on. Janet, thank you.
I'm always befuddled by microphones. I cannot start this paper without acknowledging that two women academics, Julia Lord and Charlotte Davis, gave me a great many of the ideas and directions for this paper over the 4 years I was an assistant professor of library science and children's literature, by lending me books, by sharing scholarship, and by discussing their findings with me. I am especially grateful that they helped me identify an academic area that paralleled my commitment as a lesbian activist. Because the issues are more important than their academic silence, and because I know how important it is that we lesbians rediscover our literary models of female crushes, affections, and friendships in children's literature, I present what they would not do. I also want to disqualify them from any responsibility for the shortcomings of this paper. In the printed brochures that have gone out for this conference, the title of this paper is called Female Crushes, Affections, and Friendships in Children's Literature. I want to add a subtitle and covert feminism. Before the 1920s, female crushes, friendships, and affections existed in most books published for children that mentioned girls. After this period, female crushes, friendships, and affections no longer are given context and are seldom mentioned in children's literature. Besides the change in cultural attitudes toward and social patterns of females just before this period, there was a change in the way the children's book industry was organized. When I first started reading books published for middle and upper class white girls before 1914, I found female crushes, friendships, and affections portrayed in most of them. I wondered if these girls' books were reflecting straight women's behavior and or straight women's fantasy, lesbian behavior and or lesbian fantasy. I knew most of the authors themselves would roll over in their graves and start digging in the direction they least intended to go to hear their work described as lesbian. The following passage is representative, and I have some slides I had made for an earlier version of this paper of females being affectionately portrayed in the book illustrations, which we also no longer have. I really have no place for them in my text, but I thought you'd enjoy seeing them while I read this passage. I don't have time to point out the symbolism in them or the importance of them, but perhaps you can ask me questions about them during the discussion. This is a quote. That evening, When the girls gathered in the gymnasium for the Saturday dance, Carol was missing. She had slipped away in her pretty white dress, and just as the music was beginning, she was knocking at the door of Castle Afterglow. No answer came. She opened the door and went in. The room was dark, but the light from the hall showed Jean huddled in a forlorn bunch on the window seat. Her head was turned away, and she was resting her forehead against the pane. "May I come in?" asked Carol. Jean started and looked at her visitor. "You poor little soul. All alone here in the doleful dark," said Carol. "May I light up? It's against the rules to come, I know, but I can't help it. I simply had to run up and see you. You don't mind if I pay you a call?" "Oh, no," said Jean longingly, for her heart was very hungry just then. Carol turned on the electric light. "Why, Jean, dear," she cried as she saw the poor girl's face. It was feverishly flushed and disfigured with the burning tears that had been shed. Jean was ashamed to have her piteous state found out and bent her head. But Carol seated herself beside the pathetic little figure and, putting her arms around her, drew her close and kissed her. "You poor little girlie," she said. "They've been martyring you. The idea of shutting you up in prison like this. It was an outrageous shame. Never mind. You just wait till Miss Carlton comes back, and she'll set things straight. But I'm glad I got the book, anyway. To think I might have gone on to the end of school and never found you out, you dear." Jean listened to the girl who had seemed so far above her and had suddenly come so close, and her poor little lonely heart began to be consoled. Yet she held herself stiff and erect, for she felt her self-control giving way under kindness. The tears were rising again, and in spite of her efforts to keep them back, down her cheeks they rolled. She tried to jerk herself away, but it was no use. Carol had seen the tears, and she drew the tired, aching head gently down on her shoulder. Then Jean gave up the struggle, and nestling close to her new friend, had her cry all over again. But all the time, there was the sense of being comforted, for Carol's arms were holding her fast, and she heard a soft voice speaking the first loving, petting words that she had heard in all those dreary months at school. Jean lifted her head at last. "I can't help it," she said. "I was so homesick, and I wanted somebody so much, and I thought nobody cared. And I was so dreadful today. I got so angry. I disgraced myself so. Oh, my head. It never ached so before." She pressed her hands to her temples, where it seemed as if hammers were pounding. "Does your head ache so, dear?" Carol stroked Jean's forehead. "Why, you poor child. Your head's burning," she exclaimed. "Bed's the place for you." "I don't want to go to bed," said Jean, too tired to stir. "Oh, yes, you do. Then we can have the light out and let in some fresh air. This room's cooking hot. I don't wonder your head aches. I'll go to bed later, but I want you now." Well, you're going to have me. I'm the one that's going to put you in bed. That's the end of the passage. I'm through with the slides. Did I get them all? Did we see them all? We saw all the slides? Okay. As a lesbian activist myself, I define lesbian as a woman who may be having sex with a male, but who is fantasizing about having sex and sharing strong affection with another woman. The girls and women in these stories clearly did desire and share strong affections and friendships with each other, for which the crush was a manifestation in a variety of conventions. Between friends, between younger and older girls, between teachers and students, mothers and daughters. In these stories, the strong and warm relationships between females overpowers everything else in their lives. Since the books in which these passages appear are in the popular bestseller genre of ego escape literature, we do know that many females enjoyed reading fantasy about giving sensuous context to their affections and friendships with each other. We also know, thanks to the pioneering research and documentation in female bonding patterns during this period by the feminist historian Carol Smith Rosenberg, that girls and women used similar language in describing their feelings and desires for each other in letters, diaries, journals. Romantic and strongly affectionate language and feelings were assumed to be natural. The cultural conventions of language and behavior for upper and middle class white women have changed. Such change does not invalidate the internal evidence that these conventions enabled women to express their feelings and desires for each other in patterns that we would identify as lesbian in feeling and behavior today. Under the subject heading, Intentions, Problems Of, in the Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, it is stated that the function of the critic is to elucidate the material at hand by distinguishing what the author intended to say from that which the work itself is about. While the author's persona might direct the tale in one direction, the work itself may be making a completely independent, if not contradictory, statement. It also states that every work of art undergoes from age to age various interpretation, taking on new significances or shedding former ones. Quote, colors which the artist neither foresaw nor intended, unquote. Writers frequently, quote, encompass more than they intend. Nothing the author asserts about her intention can possibly establish the status of her work of art, for obviously what tests it as such is finally the work itself, unquote. Therefore, while the authors might have intended no lesbian interpretation of these passages, nonetheless, when we evaluate them in our own time, we see that the convention that existed is an emotional and social model for an Amazon nation. I would suggest that there are several reasons why children's literature no longer provides us with examples and models of this kind of behavior. The change of the definition of children's literature, the change of definitions in children's literature, the change of control and distribution of children's literature, the consequent change of bonding behavior around the time of the popularization of Freud, with the accompanying change in the strengths, commitments, and priorities of relationships between women. Before the 1920s, the term children would have been a much more inclusive term than it is today. In 1974, most of us involved with the United States education system and the field of psychology perceived children as those people of elementary school age, that is, of sixth grade age or 12 years old and younger. At the turn of the century, the concept of childhood would not have been applied solely to this age group. The white, middle, and upper class would have applied the concept of childhood to those young people who did not work, including up to the equivalent of high school age students today. Therefore, children who worked in mines and factories from a very young age would not have experienced childhood as we know it, or as these books describe it. This class-defined concept of childhood would affect the kind of literature parents and relatives would have called children's literature, and therefore it is also determined which books were given to children to read. Many of you may be surprised that I got the passage about Jean and Carol from one of the most widely circulated children's magazines ever published in our country, St. Nicholas, 1873 to 1939. St. Nicholas was especially popular during the editorship of Mary Mapes Dodge, who was the editor 1873 to 1905, and who was the author of Hans Brinker or The Silver Skates. There has not been an equivalent magazine published especially for children during the childhood periods of most of us in this room. Think, for example, of what we suffered through in elementary school. You know, those weekly readers? And Scholastic magazine. You know, St. Nicholas was so much better. May Lamberton Becker, a later editor, introduced the St. Nicholas anthology in 1948 with the following warm memories. Quote, each of us on our block read every word of it. That's never the way we felt about our weekly readers. Those who did not subscribe borrowed it from their best friends, and those who did kept track of each copy, lest it should be too often borrowed away and lost. This magazine had something about everything, all together in one delicious assortment for us to choose what and when we pleased. There has not been a written work published for contemporary childhood culture that would circulate and be treasured by children as this magazine was, except perhaps for certain issues of comic books and maybe bubblegum cards. But St. Nicholas served a different function in the lives of its subscribers than comic books and bubblegum cards play in our own time. One primary difference is that adults, namely children's parents, approved of it and read it too. An entire family, that is, what we would call an extended family today, would sit around the fireside and read it out loud together. Today, television or a movie might bring a family together, but that is not the same kind of participatory, congenial atmosphere for everyone that reading out loud before a fire is. Another important difference is that any child with the ability to read it could and would, and that even non-readers heard the stories along with the rest of the family. Standard-Binet and Iowa tests did not dictate what was appropriate reading level matter for the adults to direct their children's reading patterns. Any child who could pick St. Nicholas up and wanted to read it did so. Therefore, St. Nicholas enjoyed contributions and a principal readership from children as young as 6 and 7, but averaging 8 years old and up. In other words, St. Nicholas enjoyed a general popularity and audience that the Walt Disney Corporation would envy. And speaking of the movies, St. Nicholas would have qualified for a G rating. Therefore, written children's literature was at once not only more inclusive about what was assumed to be natural concerning the human condition, but also children had adult-approved access to it at a much earlier age than they do today. Furthermore, both adults and children read it together. Another important distinction between literature published then for children and literature published now is that the evidence would indicate the children selected and purchased it themselves. Today, children have no control and little choice about what is written for them, selected for publication for them, distributed for them, reviewed for them, and purchased for them. In fact, I would suggest that the reason the average child in our country prefers to watch 52 hours of television a week for her entertainment and information, instead of reading anything that is not compulsory, is because the written literature available for children is as irrelevant to their lives as it is to us adults. I feel it is important to identify the group of people who contributed to and who are largely responsible for this dramatic change in children's literature. In America, we associate the children's librarian with the infallible innocence of angels and apple pie. Scholars, children, and parents have not given enough thought or consideration to the power and importance her book budget and opinion represent. Publishers have recognized her influence and power, however, since the 1920s, and the publishers with the largest children's departments are especially sensitive to her budget and opinion. Before the growth of children's librarianship, the evidence would indicate that there were numerous places where children could purchase and select children's books themselves all over this country. In 1974, when we consider book outlets for children, we think of a little shelf or two in the back of an adult bookstore composed primarily of classic selections and a limited selection of a narrow range of recently published paperbacks. At best, even in our large cities, it is hard to find even one bookstore that is exclusively devoted to children's books. When children think of buying something to inform or to entertain themselves, they buy comic books, records, toys, candy, and gum. Not books. Children's book literature remains big business, regardless of the children. Public and school children's libraries have combined budgets of millions of dollars, which are further supplemented by state and federal funds. The adults who are children's librarians determine how they spend those funds. In library language, such power is euphemistically called responsibility of choice. The typical librarian bases her responsible choices on the reviews she reads in a handful of magazines that review children's books. The reviews are written by librarians. The education which might give librarians the background to write informed and intelligent reviews is not available in any of our professional schools. Library science curricula do not require either courses in literature or in criticism, nor do they offer courses in aesthetics, history of literature, art history, linguistics, or any other respected and established academic field. Nor are the faculty qualified to teach such courses. Professional library literature does not represent the contributions of scholars or intellectuals. In fact, outside of professional library circles, I don't know who would tolerate such reviews as, "This little sweet and sentimental book is appropriate and suitable for any library. The little children will love it." To a librarian, this is a signal that no one in the community will object to it. And therefore, the book is a safe purchase that will not cost the librarian her job, headlines, or any other unpleasantness. The kind of issues that children's librarians identify as a crisis is exemplified by the experiences of a colleague of mine. My colleague had reviewed a children's book for a professional library journal. Another librarian responded, reprimanding her for not having mentioned the existence of obscenities in the book. My colleague reread the book. She could not find any obscenities. Then a friend of hers pointed out a section in the book that satirizes a cartoon. People are no damned good. Most children's librarians read reviews not to distinguish important themes common to all womankind, or to determine if a book has literary merit, but to find out if cuss words and blasphemy, such as phrases like, "Oh God," are in the book. The reviewer for a library journal is not responsible for, nor expected to produce, any critical review of the literature itself. She is only responsible for distinguishing all passages which might be offensive to anyone, elitists, racists, and sexists excluded. In this way, librarians will know not to buy books negatively identified by these reviews, and the criteria of responsibility of choice will have been aptly applied. Let me not fail to make clear that I believe there is children's literature librarians' monopoly on children's literature books. And this monopoly is more insidious to our national interests than the gas and oil monopoly, the food distribution monopoly, the assassinations of our popular leaders, and the Yankee Cowboy Watergate conspiracy for control of our country. Wittingly and unwittingly, these women decided not to support certain kinds of fantasies and models of behavior portrayed in children's literature, and children's literature changed. I see children's literature librarians as more insidious because they would not have identified themselves as a monopoly, which they certainly were and continue to be, nor did they envision or consider the implications of their actions. The only issue they could identify is to keep people like me, who are different, out of their circles and to create a string of appropriate and suitable uniform books coming into their tax-supported libraries. Children's rooms in public libraries are a relatively recent innovation. The first library building designed to include a room especially for children was not built until 1895 at Pratt Free Institute Library in Brooklyn. Ann Carol Moore, the professional librarian who would mother children's librarianship, received her appointment at Pratt as children's librarian in 1896. By 1905, her reputation was such that Dr. Bostwick, director of the New York Public Library, asked her to direct the work with children at 42nd Street. From 1906 until her retirement from the New York Public Library on October 1, 1941, she directed children's services in the children's room there. That children's room was not all she directed. No one would disagree with Frances Clark Sayers, her protege biographer's eulogy, quote, "And there was an end to 35 years of being the center of a universe, the boundaries of which she herself had extended beyond the expectations of any librarian in a comparable position. Hers was the authoritative voice in the world of children's books. With the growth of her influence through the Bookman, the Herald Tribune books, and the Horn book, to say nothing of the book selection policies of the New York Public Library, her voice remained in command," unquote. Being the center of a universe, most of us would consider many other people and even things with which to identify before we would dream of Ann Carol Moore as someone who changed our boundaries when she extended hers. What does it mean, after all, if someone sets up a children's room with books, African violets, dried pine cones, and wears clean yellow shoes? Hers was the authoritative voice in the world of children's books. When she acquired the exclusive privilege of the major review media of children's books, she had also gained a strong voice in publishers' offices, the Bookman, the Herald Tribune Books, and the Horn Book were journals that librarians read to find out how they should spend their budgets. Librarians had become a massive buying bloc for children's books. Today, children's librarians purchase 95% of the United States children's book market. When a corporation like AT&T has 95% exclusive control over its product and distribution, we call it a monopoly. When an organization like the AMA has exclusive control on its services, we call it a monopoly. When that organization markets ideas and values like Madison Avenue, we call them panderers of the popular culture. I lost my text. Children's librarians have become a monopoly to children's literature. Anne Carroll Moore was one of the most authoritative voices in the whole field. Quote, take, for example, as Mrs. Sayers would say, her Seven Stories High, created originally as an accompaniment to an article on reading for Compton's Pictured Encyclopedia in 1932. Books for a Child's Own Library was its theme. It appeared as a distinctive reprint year after year, the revisions being made by ACM throughout the years of its publication. In all probability, it influenced more homes, schools, libraries, and bookshops than any other book list of its era. And more than one school of librarianship used it as a text of perfection, unquote. Such a statement could be said about few items as influential in any field. From this text of perfection, publishers, authors, and book illustrators, whom she included on her list, made a great deal of money. Frances Clark Sayers herself says, quote, the annual appearance of her children's books suggested as holiday gifts issued by the New York Public Library represented her wise and discerning choice of the year's output, and publishers, authors, and artists alike hoped beyond hope that the books for which they were responsible would find a place on the Christmas lists of her choosing. That would be the dates 1918 to 1941, unquote. At the 42nd Street Library, she was within walking distance of the major publishers' offices, all north of the Mason-Dixon line and east of the Schuylkill. Frances Clark Sayers omits mentioning that the major children's editors of Harper, Viking, and Houghton Mifflin, that is, the major selectors of what would be published for children, walked their galleys themselves to her office. There was a little ritual those powerful editors went through. Good morning. And how are you this morning? Very well, I hope. That is, these powerful editors said it to her doll, Nicholas. Through the 1940s, and through the doors of the Children's Department of the New York Public Library, manuscripts would only be cleared after this little ritual. Anne Carroll Moore read everything that might be published, and had certainly read everything that was published. One day, Ursula Nordstrom, the new editor for Harper's, decided to publish E.B. White's Stuart Little. She did not review the text with Anne Carroll Moore. She got a call. She went to Anne Carroll Moore's office. She did not say, good morning, how are you this morning? To Nicholas, the doll. She went directly into Anne Carroll Moore's office, who said, you may not publish this book. Ursula Nordstrom responded, I may, I can, I plan to. She did. Library journals reviewed Stuart Little and found it controversial because a mouse is born of human parents. E.B. White never received the recognition he deserved for either Charlotte's Web or Stuart Little as the author of the most distinguished contribution to American literature for children, as the recipient for the Newbery Award. In fact, no author from Harper's received the Newbery Award until 1955. No Harper artist received the Caldecott Award for the most distinguished illustrator until 1957. The Newbery and Caldecott Awards are the highest honors an author and illustrator respectively may earn in children's literature. In book publishing, these awards assure the author, artist, publisher a steady income for a period of years, since most librarians feel obligated to buy each winner, frequently in multiple copies. The founder of this award, Frederick Melker, was the editor of Publishers Weekly and a professional friend of Anne Carroll Moore's. She had the power of determining this important and profitable honor. If Anne Carroll Moore had wanted female crushes, affections, and friendships portrayed in children's literature, such relationships would be there. 19th century children's literature had racism, elitism, and sexism, as well as powerful descriptions of hate, anger, jealousy, and love. After Anne Carroll Moore's influence, children's literature had racism, elitism, and sexism, but it no longer had powerful statements about any kind of emotion. By 1906, when Anne Carroll Moore became head of the children's division of the New York Public Library, she gave high priority to going to each of the 36 branches and, as Francis Clark Sayre says, quote, sniffing out the quality of the book collections, noting the lack of judgment or any clear policy of selection, the remnants of Sunday school libraries and cheap sensationalism showing through the skeletal beginnings of professional concern for the books children read, unquote. From the turn that children's literature took under Anne Carroll Moore's growing influence, the context that librarians give the phrase cheap sensationalism affected what was found on the bookshelves. Cheap sensationalism does not mean an overly contrived story with unbelievable characters and incidents. The term cheap sensationalism meant characters in the story who expressed the emotions of anger, jealousy, hate, love, even greed. These human temptations and pleasures were excluded, and if there at all, severely modified and retold. It also meant characters touching each other, because after this period, we do not find even parents and children touching each other, no less members of the same sex in children's literature. All of us know from our own experience that parents and children continue to touch each other. Some of us know from our own experience playing children's games, like Doctor, that children of the same sex and children of the opposite sex continue to enjoy touching each other. Therefore, it is indeed curious why such passages stopped appearing. I have wondered for a long time why Anne Carroll Moore and her children's librarian and editor friends gave such high priority to removing passion from children's literature. Anne Carroll Moore and most of her generation of librarians and children's editors are dead, appalled, humiliated, slandered, horrified, are not strong enough words to describe how they would feel if they could be with us today on this lesbian platform. And yet, the glimpses of external evidence from their professional and personal lives would indicate that they could be nothing but defensive about and sensitive to being called lesbians. These librarians had created a professional and personal world in which they hardly ever had to see men. Not only did they work together, they also dined, summered, and lived together. We know in the 19th century that women neighbors and relatives had a highly complex network of visiting each other frequently, writing often, working together, and being very affectionate and emotionally attached to one another. Women in the 19th century assumed these relationships they cherished with each other were natural. The following is an excerpt from a letter of a mother to her daughter, quote, "You do not know how much I miss you. Not only when I struggle in and out of my mortal envelope and pump my nightly potation and no longer pour into your sympathizing ear my senile gossip, but all the day I muse away, since the sound of your voice no longer rouses me to sympathy with your joys or sorrows. You cannot know how much I miss your affectionate demonstrations," unquote. These women had widely recognized conventions in a social and familial system as models within which they developed their friendships. These women had probably never heard the word lesbian, and if they had, they would probably have not thought of applying it to themselves. In the 19th century, there was not the same kind of cultural repression that we women experience in the 20th. Historians cannot yet tell us why this is so. Anne Carroll Moore was not the only person who thought and spoke the way she did. She was an especially powerful and influential spokesperson for what had become a cultural change in attitudes toward female relationships. By taking the professional and personal position she did, she affected and reinforced a pattern against female relationships so that the pattern became much more pervasive and insular than it may have been otherwise. Her career and personal life as a single woman tragically point out what happened when our culture changed its attitude toward females and how that change of attitude affected the rest of us.
WBAI, New York.
I do have a passage about Anne Carroll Moore's highly defensive objections to sharing a room at a library convention with another woman from a relatively public round robin letter to her classmates from college, not long after graduation and after her appointment at Pratt. Quote, "I was forced to share with a gaunt female from the state of Iowa. My first impression, she in red flannel petticoat attired, one or two other nondescript articles of dress, not to be mentioned in these pages, was not conducive to sisterly affection. I love the human race, but when it comes to sleeping with them promiscuously, I am reluctant." Unquote. The only women I know who would highlight such an incident in this manner are women who are self-conscious that someone else might consider them a lesbian. If someone is so defensive about this kind of personal encounter, then she is probably going to be threatened as well by passages such as the following. Gloria has rescued Jack, another girl at the school, by leaping into icy water, swimming out to the canoe where Jack lay unconscious, removing Jack's petticoat, and holding it up as a sail in order to return them both to shore. The illustration for this is marvelous. I didn't have it. Gloria and Trixie, roommates and friends, now talk about Gloria seeing Jack after the rescue. "Oh, you needn't worry that she'll gush over the heroic rescue," interrupted Trixie. "Jack is as sobered as if she had just dashed through the rapids. There is plainly something worrying her. I hope she won't transfer the worry to you, little girl." Affection warmed the sentence. "For I'm just as proud and bit more proud of you than are any of the others. After all, you are my own special little Gloria." The flushed cheek was pressed with Trixie's eager lips. and for a few moments they became again the chums they used to be before Altamont, the fashionable boarding school, had imposed its estranging influence. "Trixie," breathed Gloria, "you do love me a little." "A lot. Why shouldn't I?" "Oh, you know, I can't forget Jean's idea of a country girl." "Queer. You do forget mine." Another frank embrace from the wonderful girl born to gentility was bestowed upon Gloria. "But run along to Jack. We have posted signs to keep the coast clear, so improve the shining moments. And oh, Gloria," as her little friend attempted to leave, "be careful to agree with her if you possibly can. The doctor was none too sure of her condition,